It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, an incredible collection of the world's seeds are being protected in remote Norway. We talk with a Wisconsin scientist who is studying that effort.
First, Governor Scott Walker announced yesterday that he wants to prolong the tuition freeze for UW schools around the state and potentially rule out budget increases for the UW system and some other state agencies in next year's budget.
But UW officials say that after years of budget cuts, the quality of the education services the school provides could get worse.
Joining us now is Nico Savage. He's higher education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Nico, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, talk about this announcement a little. Give us some backstory here. How long has this tuition freeze been in effect?
Sure. So tuition at UW institutions for in-state undergraduates has been frozen since 2013. At UW-Madison, it's been frozen at about $10,400. And that freeze came after several years, and in fact, decades, in which tuition had been rising at well above the cost of inflation. It was put into place by Walker and Governor Walker and Republicans in the legislature, and has proved fairly popular. Pretty wide support for it when it was introduced, and still fairly wide support for it, according to some polling that we've seen. And now it looks like the governor is trying to is indicating that he'll be including two more years of the tuition freeze in his next budget, which would carry that through the 2019 school year.
This budget process is still months away, but the governor is sending some pretty strong signals pretty early here when it comes to UW funding.
That's true, and it's looking today like one option that could see UW get some increased state funding is apparently still on the table. So the governor in his message yesterday told just about all state agencies, all but a handful, that they pretty much should not expect any additional state money, and UW is one of those agencies that kind of heard this message of don't expect any more money. However, the governor's office says today that an idea that Governor Walker had floated earlier this summer of tying some new state funding for UW to performance measures and how UW does in certain criteria, that option is apparently still on the table. So that's still something that the governor is considering as an option in the next state budget.
And that performance-based budget increase sounds like there's a lot of question marks. Nobody's clear at this point what measures would be in place, how this would work. This has got a new territory for UW schools, right?
Right. For UW, it would be, and the governor's office hasn't said what those measures would be. They have pointed to, though there are some performance-based funding components in the budget for the Wisconsin Technical College system. So, for instance, the Technical College system gets funding that is based in part on how well it does in metrics like the number of degrees it awards in high-demand fields, the job placement rates of graduates, that sort of thing. It's not clear if we'd see the same criteria used for UW schools or if we'd potentially see some different ones, but that's certainly something that a lot of people are looking at is just what are these criteria going to be and what that is going to mean for the UW.
We're talking to Nico Savage, higher education reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal, looking at the governor's announcement that in the next budget coming up next year, he would like to see no funding increase for the state UW system, apart from possibly a performance-based set of increases, and no tuition increase, keeping the tuition freeze alive. So, Nico, that performance increase sounds like a maybe clear signal here about no other funding increase or tuition freeze in the governor's budget plan. How are UW system representatives reacting to that?
Well, one thing they're saying is, first of all, in response to the tuition freeze, they're saying that, look, we want college to be affordable. Two, we are committed to access. But at the same time, what UW officials say is that, look, if you just freeze tuition and there's no there's no further investment from the state, that, you know, their costs are going up each year, and that creates problems for UW. I mean, we've seen several campuses in reaction to the last state budget, which cut UW funding by $250 million over 2 years, and of course had the tuition freeze. We've seen several UW campuses reduce their class offerings, reduce their advising services. The number of course sections have been reduced, and you know, UW officials pointing out today that can potentially lead to it taking more time to graduate. And, you know, if you have to go to 4 years of school instead of three or three and a half, they say, well, that's more money in the long run, even if tuition is frozen. So what they're saying is they want to see, and we've heard this from UW officials as well as faculty and others who have coined a hashtag called Fund the Freeze. They want the state to be kind of paying for that tuition freeze as opposed to just freezing tuition and leaving UW to make up the money through cuts.
But they're making the case that if they don't get that, if they have the tuition freeze and a flat budget after some budget cuts in the past, they're saying this will affect the quality of higher education?
That's been more of a message that we've seen from faculty, from UW supporters, from Democrats in the legislature. I don't think we've seen, UW officials, chancellors and that sort of thing, quite going that dire with their messages yet. But it's certainly something we've seen from supporters of the system.
And looking at the legislature, Governor Walker doesn't write the budget on his own. Has there been reaction, first of all, from currently majority Republicans in either chamber?
I haven't seen a reaction yet from Republicans. I did see Representative Peter Barca, the Assembly Democratic leader, raised a similar to issue as UW officials, saying that the tuition freeze is only helpful if he funds it, and saying that it's referring to this as a zero growth budget, quoting from Representative Barca, that reflects the zero growth results Wisconsinites have seen under Republicans in power. So certainly some skepticism from Representative Barca there.
How extensive have cuts been in state funding for the UW system in the last couple of budgets?
Well, in five of the last six budgets, Wisconsin has cut the UW system's budget. Like I said, most recently, $250 million over 2 years in the most recent one. So, UW officials are basically saying, and they've been saying for a while now, certainly since the summer of 2015 when that budget cut was happening, that, they've cut to the bone and they're sort of in danger at this point of bad stuff happening, really bad stuff happening.
Now, the UW system not the only one hearing this news of a flat budget. Is there any indication of where the governor might consider budget increases?
Yeah, so Governor Walker's spokesman basically says, and the governor himself said in this memo to state agency heads that he sent last week, that one of his priorities is going to be increasing funding for K-12 education. That's one that he's mentioned. Spokesman for the governor saying today he's also has reducing property taxes as a priority. Also mentions the governor does a few kind of basic, what he describes as basic cost to continue increases for departments such as corrections, health services, children and families, workforce development, a smattering of other state agencies.
Now, this budget announcement, budget memo is out probably before it needs to be, but it's going to give people a lot of time to respond, and it comes out before the state legislative elections. Do you think that this is going to be, higher education funding is going to be a hot issue for politicians here in the state between now and November?
Well, we've seen some indications of that over the past few months. We've definitely seen Democrats looking to kind of press this issue of, these cuts to UW are too big. According to them, they are having negative effects on students. They're having negative effects on the communities that benefit from UW institutions. And according to Democrats, they're having negative effects on Wisconsin's economy. So certainly we've seen Democrats looking to push on this issue of budget cuts and the idea that UW is in a position where it needs more money and presenting themselves as the party that's going to make that happen. But we've also seen Governor Walker and Republicans kind of picking up the banner of college affordability with the tuition freeze and also with some of the legislation that was passed earlier this year on college affordability issues. So they kind of have that response where they can say, tuition went up under Democratic administrations. So we've seen Governor Walker kind of talk about the increases to tuition that were happening before the freeze and making the argument that it's the tuition freeze championed by Republicans that has saved students thousands of dollars if you look at what you might have been saving over the course of 4 years of tuition increases if that was the case.
Well, the budget process goes into the summer. I imagine we'll be talking to you about this again before then, Nico. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Nico Savage, higher education reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal. He joined us to talk about a potential tuition freeze and stalled funding at the UW system. You are listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we continue our series of candidate forums with a Democrat running for a congressional seat in Wisconsin's 1st District.
Right now, it sounds like something out of a James Bond movie, a fortress in remote Norway protecting a global treasure. But it does exist, and the precious treasure is the world's diversity of seeds.
The Svalbard Global Seed Vault is located on an island halfway between Norway and the North Pole, and it's built to withstand any foreseeable disaster, whether natural or man-made.
Its mission is to preserve the genetic diversity of the Earth's seeds, specifically of the world's agricultural plants. Currently, the vault holds more than 860,000 samples originating from almost every country on the planet. Even though that's just a fraction of the vault's storage capacity, it already holds the most diverse collection of food crop seeds in the world.
Tracy Hetherington is an associate professor of anthropology and associate dean of the graduate school at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She's been studying the seed vault for several years and joins us now from our Milwaukee studios. Tracy, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, can you start by describing the Svalbard Global Seed Vault for us? What is it and what does it look like?
Well, it is basically a very large storage building built into the side of a mountain in northern Norway in the Arctic permafrost region. And it is set up in order to take backup samples of seeds from seed banks and research facilities around the world.
So this is not the only seed bank in the world, but it sounds as though this was intended to be the seed bank of last resort.
That's one way of putting it. I think the Svalbard Global Seed Vault is a very, very important backup storage space. So what happens is that you have about 1,400 seed banks around the world, 1,700 seed banks around the world that are living seed banks. And we call them living seed banks because these are the facilities that are not only storing seeds, but constantly regenerating seeds, making sure that the genetic samples they have remain viable so that when you plant them again, they will continue to reproduce seed once again. And of course, every time you grow out a set of seed samples, you also have the issue of needing to check to make sure that those samples are continuing to remain true to type, as they say. So it's very necessary to plant things out and regrow them on a regular basis. And of course, depending on what kind of seeds you're using, there are longer or shorter storage times. But if you store them at minus 18 degrees Celsius, minus 20 degrees Celsius with a very low humidity, you stand a good chance of keeping them for a very long time. So what they do is that they realize that if you have seeds stored in a single institution, they still remain vulnerable. Ultimately, if something happens to the power supply, if something happens that their maintenance schedule can't be maintained because of budget cuts, if something happens that the personnel who are responsible for maintaining the facility have to change over and something gets lost or misplaced, you want to have that additional secondary storage site that enables you to replace samples that could be lost. And there are a variety of reasons why that could be happening. Why that could happen. So it's incredibly important that people have come together to try and work out a global system, a global database, a global initiative in order to make sure that we have these seeds conserved.
And you're an anthropologist, which is an interesting angle into all of this because you're not coming at it as a botanist or biologist, but you're also interested in the aspect of this that involves global cooperation. What parts of that interest you the most?
Well, the fact that what we're witnessing here is really a common property system in the making. This is a new era for thinking about the global public good. How do we think about a global commons writ large? How do we work it out? You know, I think most of our initiatives that have transcended the nation state level are still based on countries making agreements and pacts between themselves and each nation sort of agreeing to what they're going to commit to writ large. When you talk about the Svalbard Global Seed Vault, what you're looking at is a really new institutional creature. It is overseen by the Global Crop Diversity Trust, which was formerly in Rome, housed at the FAO facilities, but has moved into Germany, in Bonn, the UN Global Sustainability Hub. And so it's very close to the headquarters of the IPCC. It's very close to a number of other international organizations that are dedicated to issues of sustainability and environmental security and thinking about the big picture. This is something really fundamentally new. It's about partnerships that span, not only nation to nation, but are also vertically complex, if you will. They're also about thinking about how those international agricultural research centers, the so-called CGIAR, centers that have been responsible for some of the most important developments in agricultural modernization, some of them very controversial, of course, but also thinking about how national seed banks fit into that, how smaller scale NGOs fit into that, thinking about how communities fit into the whole picture. And so you're starting to see some very, very interesting collaborations that take us beyond what we've ever imagined in terms of how to conserve things, how to think about biodiversity, how to think about a global commons, how to work together on it. Some of those collaborations are public-private. Some of it is thinking about, how do we imagine a global public good? How do we ensure it? How do we make sure it's safe at a whole variety of levels? So I, from an anthropological perspective, that's just incredibly interesting, and it's very much about the people at the heart of it who are making these initiatives, who are interpreting laws, who are implementing mandates, who are changing institutions from within in order to make things work.
Tracy Hetherington is with us right now. She's an associate professor of anthropology at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and she's been studying the Svalbard Global Seed Vault for several years. And Tracy, you mentioned a bit earlier that the seed vault in Norway is not at capacity yet. There's room there. So I'm wondering about what sorts of seeds are yet to come and what cooperation is yet to come to fill the vault and what that might look like.
Well, there is a lot to be done. I think one of the things the Global Crop Diversity Trust is working on today is figuring out how to help out many of the smaller seed banks in developing areas. Now, we have a pretty good part of the really important international collections from the major international agricultural research centers already there because they've been collaborating on this initiative from the outset. But there are also some very, very important smaller collections that are housed in smaller national seed banks, sometimes university facilities or research centers of different kinds, that also have collections that could potentially be very valuable for the future. And so ensuring that they have the ability to choose to send things to the vault to facilitate it is one of the big priorities, to make sure that all our major food crops around the world, the Annex I food crops that are designated by the International Plant Treaty, actually go in the vault. So there's a lot of work to be done, particularly with the smaller banks supporting developing areas, institutions. And there are also things like wild crop relatives that are increasingly recognized as potentially important in agricultural research that could help us find find crops that have the capacity to help us adapt to climate change.
And Tracy, to bring this home, make it more immediate, what are some of the biggest real-world threats to seed diversity? In other words, why might we need to go to the seed vault and take out seeds?
Well, you know, there are the simple things that we sort of take for granted. The creeping weirdness of the weather being one of them. Anybody who has planted some tomatoes that fell to rust or some sort of disease or a pest, and then couldn't harvest those crops, couldn't have chosen to save the seeds, for example, you see one of the biggest issues. Now, weather can come in a variety of forms. You can get much more extreme weather patterns in many places of the world. You have creeping droughts, the slow change of what kinds of microclimates people have grown used to and depended upon in the past, the availability of rainfall or, flooding. So the places where we are growing particular kinds of crops are, in fact, changing. Some areas in the highlands around the world, for example, you may have heard of the very famous potato park in Peru, where many Andean farmers have been growing potatoes for centuries. And they have had to basically move up the mountain in search of the microclimates where there are particular varieties of potato grow best. So, the sense of varying climates becomes very very dramatic.
And Tracy, we have to leave it there. Appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Tracy Hetherington is an associate professor of anthropology and associate dean of the graduate school at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She's been studying the Svalbard Global Seed Vault in Norway for several years.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk to one of the Democratic candidates for Congress running in the 1st Congressional District. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, our guest turns a critical eye towards the way that the science fiction genre handles issues of race.
First, we're continuing our series of interviews with candidates in contested districts ahead of the August 9th primaries in Wisconsin. We've invited candidates running in Wisconsin's congressional primaries to join us on Central Time and the Joy Cardine Show.
Joining us now is Tom Bry. He's a Democratic candidate for Congress in the 1st District in the southern part of the state, where Speaker of the House Paul Ryan is the incumbent. His Democratic opponent, Ryan Solon, joined us yesterday at this time. We'll talk to the Republican candidates tomorrow and Thursday. Tom Bry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, why are you running for Congress?
I'm a fairly typical, mostly normal, working stiff who, by chance, 11 years ago, got hooked into politics. So one way of looking at this campaign is that it's really a natural progression of my growing activism over the past 11 years.
What is it that hooked you into politics?
What specifically happened 11 years ago, actually to the day of the primary, August 9th, so August 9th, 2005, one of our kids, we have seven kids, one of our kids, David, was working on a Boy Scout merit badge. We backed it out that it was a citizenship in the nation, and in order to do a check mark on one of the boxes, David needed to attend a political event. That was the first political event I ever attended. It was Paul Ryan debating economist Dean Baker on privatizing Social Security. I walked in there, again, retirement was pretty far distant, not a very low information voter, again, seven kids, work, family, all that stuff. But I remember walking to the car after the debate, wondering to myself, holy cow, how could Paul Ryan have been elected? He has such a narrow viewpoint, so very privileged, absolutely out of touch with what most people are facing.
Tell us some about your background and how it prepares you for a run for Congress.
Sure. You know, roots make a difference. I was born and raised in Marshfield, Wisconsin, right in the center of the state, ninth of 12 children, fifth generation Wisconsinite. Dad fought in World War II, worked at the Marshfield Brewery until it closed, and then at the post office. Mom was a nurse. So when Mike McCabe speak, the Blue Jean Nation guy, I'm a commoner. I wear blue jeans when I campaign. I'm wearing blue jeans now. So roots do make a difference, and background does make a difference. So after high school, I got a math degree from Viterbo College in La Crosse. A couple years later, I went back to school and got a business degree from UW-Stevens Point. And then I worked for 5 years as a state bank examiner out of Eau Claire. I went back to school one final time. I got a mechanical engineering degree from UW-Madison. I graduated, got married, a job opened up in Janesville, and that's where my wife Sylvia and I have been raising our seven kids ever since. For the last 20 years, I've been specializing in plumbing design in the building trades. No, I'm not a real plumber, but I love my job, I love raising a family, but one thing that has become crystal clear is that Paul Ryan has absolutely taken the country the wrong direction.
We'll talk more about Congressman Ryan in just a bit, but right now you've got a primary election next Tuesday. You're running against Ryan Solon. How would you distinguish yourself for voters between you and your opponent in this primary?
There's quite a bit of difference. Even Ryan Solon, when he announced 4 or 5 months ago on his website, not a lot of content at that time, but he did say that he always thought of himself as a Republican. So at the very least, he's a moderate Democrat. But there are a number of issues where he toes, not a progressive liberal line. I'm definitely a Bernie Sanders supporter. Ryan Solon is for a flat tax. That's pretty unusual for a Democrat. Ryan Solon makes of balancing the budget a very top item. Socially, he's pretty conservative on abortion rights, for example. I'm a big believer in Roe v. Wade. It should be a woman's unencumbered choice to have an abortion. And a couple other things. But Ryan is definitely, there's a choice there.
We're talking to Tom Brye, Democratic candidate for Congress in the 1st District. August primary coming up next week, Tuesday. He's on the Democratic primary side of the ticket there. Now, if you win the primary on Tuesday, what issues do you see yourself focusing on in a race against potentially Speaker Ryan or his challenger, Paul Nealon?
Sure. Well, I hope it's Paul Nealon, because getting Paul Ryan out was the reason I jumped in the first place. But I get that question a lot. I did announce 21 months ago, the day after the last loss, where Paul Ryan beat Rob Zurbon. But first and foremost, the top issue is money, or follow the money, or Wall Street, or a lot of different ways to parse that, the growing economic inequality, the corrupting influence of money, Citizens United. So all that, again, right along with Bernie, whether you call it the 1% or the billionaires or the donor class, the tables are stacked, the laws are stacked. We're in a second Gilded Age. So that is absolutely the number one issue. And pretty much everything else flows from that, because on the GOP side, they say, well, we have no money, so we can't do roads, we can't invest in schools, can't invest in green energy, all those things. It all comes back to money as the number one issue.
So what would you do to rein in money in politics? You're referring to Citizens United. And let's take that first, then we'll get into the budget. First of all, campaign finance. What changes would you like to see?
Well, again, it's too bad that we're to the point that people on Citizens United, that, you know, does anybody really believe that a corporation is a person or that money is speech? So I absolutely support if someone wants to amend the Constitution to throw that in. It is kind of a sad compliment at the current state of affairs that we even have to say that, but absolutely a full supporter of Citizens United. What would I do? Again, even on my website, if balancing your budget is the critical issue, we could do that. Like Elizabeth Warren says, budgets are about priorities. So the first thing I would do is, or one of the things, one of the two or three things that certainly have been listed out, is I would reintroduce or co-sponsor or sponsor H.R. 4191, Representative Peter DeFazio's Oregon Wall Street transaction tax. That's projected to bring in $150 billion a year when fully implemented. Our current deficit ending September 30 was about $450 billion. So you would clean up a third of that deficit by just passing that one bill. And we need to do it for two or three other reasons. So, again, Paul, another big one. Paul Ryan wants to increase federal defense spending this year by $18 billion. Well, a real test of America would be, instead of escalating defense spending, is let's cut it back. Let's set a goal of reducing defense spending by $100 billion. That's $250 billion out of the $450 deficit right there. I got three other things on the website. Balanced up is easy if that's the highest priority, and we do it for all the other reasons, too.
There's a good chance that a Republican majority will continue after this election. Not a sure thing, but it seems likely. If you are in a Democratic minority in the House of Representatives, how would you see yourself working with a Republican majority to try to get some of these things passed?
Sure. This could easily be a change election. 2010, Governor Walker, certainly in Wisconsin, the Republican swing, but we're seeing it all across the country, that people are getting fed up, or they're, the populism of Bernie Sanders on the left and the populism of Donald Trump on the right shows that there's a lot of frustration and anger out there. So this could be a change election. So we could at least improve the number of seats in the House, and who knows where that can go. But one of the on former Secretary of State George Shultz was asked a Time magazine interview, the back page a year or so ago. The question was, well, what about this dysfunction in Congress? And he listed his three top issues. First two are not so easy, but the third one was representatives don't talk with each other across the aisle. Well, that's a pretty easy one, and I don't need to be an incumbent for 20 years to start addressing that one. So I have an authorized statement on my website that I would do what I've called collegiality lunches. I'd say, starting day one, the first term, I would contact the other 434 representatives and invite each and every one of them individually to have lunch and talk. So right there is something I could do without having, being a chairman of the Ways and Means Committee or whatever.
We're talking to Tom Bry. He's a candidate for Congress in Wisconsin's 1st District Democratic primary. Speaker Paul Ryan is the incumbent there.
And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for Tom Bry, and what should Congress focus on next year? If you live in the 1st Congressional District, what's the most important issue in your area? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up that conversation after a short break. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're talking right now with Tom Bry, candidate for Congress in the 1st District Democratic primary.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for the candidate? What is the most important issue facing Congress next year? And if you're from the 1st District in southern and southeastern Wisconsin, what issues are most important in your neck of the woods? Call in now, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Tom, you mentioned you were a Bernie Sanders supporter.
Yes.
Still are, though he's out of the race now.
Yes.
If you are the Democratic candidate, and of course Hillary Clinton is the Democratic candidate for president, would you openly support her? Would you campaign with her given the opportunity?
Yeah, we've already crossed that bridge. Bernie Sanders did endorse Hillary. There is a reality factor. I'm an engineer, after all, so I understand that it's a two-party system in this country. So I have posted on my Facebook page the day or two after Bernie endorsed her himself that, yes, I would support Hillary Clinton. She's, watched the DNC, the convention this past week, and I knew a fair amount about her, but I was pretty impressed with what she's been doing under, her husband Bill Clinton when he was talking about her. She's worked at this kind of stuff for a very long time. I definitely would have preferred Bernie Sanders on some of the issues, but Hillary's come along. She's now rejected TPP. She's come out for free tuition on higher education. So Bernie has moved her a good distance to the left, and yes, I would definitely support her.
Let's stay with the issue of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and free trade agreements in general. What would you like to see happen?
There's no such thing as free trade. There's always slanting there. Even, you know, go back to Greece, whoever got the order for the oars on those triremes, you got to believe they made a lot of money on it. So it's a misdirection to say that free trade, there's no such thing as free trade. It's always about getting the balance in there. TPP is not about good-paying American jobs. It was written of, by, and for the multinational corporations to take care of the markets, to make a profit. So it's, again, they're taking care of themselves. Again, for example, just a couple days ago, there was an article in the newspapers about how there's a task force going over to Malaysia, one of the 12 countries in the TPP, investigating mass graves of human trafficking victims. June 1st of last year, Paul Ryan, there was a problem with the TPP because Malaysia is a known human trafficker. They don't get most favored nation status, trade status, so that was a monkey wrench. So Paul Ryan wrote a pro-slavery workaround so that we could proceed with TPP. So again, clearly for those people in Malaysia who are being exploited by their bosses, this is not going to benefit them. So again, TPP is not about good-paying American jobs.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Mike is on the line in Franklin. Mike, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Yes, my biggest problem with Paul Ryan, and I'm in the 1st District, is he wants to privatize Medicare. I mean, he wants to voucherize Medicare. And me, I'm on it now. But my children are all in their 40s. And guess what? If we do this, they're never going to be able to retire because they're never going to have health insurance, because unless you're a very wealthy person, you're not going to be able to afford the health insurance when you're over 65 years old.
Mike, thanks for the call. Tom, let's talk about Medicare and health care more generally.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with Mike. Again, the other way not to be in trouble is to not get sick. You know, that would work too. But health care, I mean, it's, my top issue is the money. I'd say my next three issues, one of those three is health care. I have definitely come out, like Bernie Sanders, for universal health care. There are a lot of ways to do it. Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All has a big advantage in that a lot of Americans understand what that means. But there are other ways out there. For example, I saw a report not too long ago where making health care like an electric utility company in the current U.S., where within a certain region there's a monopoly that would cancel out the insurance companies and all that internecine competition, have it overseen by a public utility board. Interesting approach. So there, again, the question is, how do we get universal health care? I don't know that Obamacare, ACA can get us there, but there are definitely, you know, ways to get there. And clearly, this is tied to minimum wage. If you have, and again, I'm a big supporter of $15, index inflation, all that, but you need to get the America off of employment-based health care, because if you're making the minimum wage, whether it's $10 or $15, there's no way you can afford the health care premiums unless your company covers it, and in a minimum wage, that's not the case. So health care is very different from where it was 100 years ago. That's all a part of it. I agree with Mike.
Talking to 1st District Congressional candidate Tom Bry. We'll go to another caller now at 800-642-1234. Tim is with us in Marinette. Tim, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I have a question for the speaker there. He talks about no free trade, you know, that there's no such thing as free trade. And I agree with that. There is no such thing as a free lunch. But yet, we're talking about free college tuition. There's no such thing as free college tuition. Someone's paying for it, namely me. I'd like to know how does that equate? How can you say no free? There's no such thing as free trade, but yet there's free college tuition.
Tim, thanks for the call. So that if we're paying for free college tuition, that might hamper some of the deficit reduction efforts you were talking about earlier.
Sure. But I disagree with them right away here. There's a huge difference between microeconomics and macroeconomics. And at a very basic level, yeah, there is no such thing as a free lunch. You can't go and get a gallon of gas from the gas station without having money. However, even at the trivial level at the micro, if you go to Woodman's at a Saturday morning at 10, you can get a pretty good darn free lunch But that's a trivial example. The bigger example here, and this feeds into the free tuition and all those other things, is Paul Ryan frequently conflates microeconomics with macroeconomics. They don't match. It's like physics and relativistic physics. They just aren't the same. For example, the stock market, market cap, you take the shares times the price, it's about $20 trillion. Frequently, once a week or so, it seems nowadays, the stock market price either rises 1% or drops 1%. So if you think of that, 20 trillion times 1%, that's 20 trillion, 2 trillion, $200 billion is created just like that over, you know, it's, that's the finance economy. So how do you, and, but that's real wealth, that can, I mean, how it's treated now. So free lunch. Well, heck, we just created $200 billion in one day. So it's the trick here is how do you, you know, reconcile the two? The federal government has a lot of assets. We talked about, or I talked about, passing H.R. 4191, tax on Wall Street. The free tuition, again, is I started out with that. My first piece of literature said free 2 years after high school, but that's a hammer. Anyone who you know on the GOP side immediately said, oh, no free lunch. So I've changed my lit to go transition from K-12 system to a K-14 system. So immediately to take out that hammer, of course it costs money for teachers, but it's an issue about priorities. It used to be an eighth grade education you could get a family supporting job. For you know, we're at a 12th grade system. You can no longer get a family supporting job. It needs to be about a priorities, just like Elizabeth Warren says. Budgets are about priorities. We can pay for that stuff if it's our goal.
Thanks for that call. Go to Jan in Beaver Dam. Hi.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I'm interested in broadband for rural communities, and I wonder if Congress can do anything about it since the state is not doing anything.
Thanks for the call. Thoughts on rural broadband, Tom?
Sure. If you even think about the Rural Electrification Act back in the 20s, is that a company can't make a profit running an electrical wire 10 miles out in the country. But the U.S. said, we're going to do this. It's something that needs to be done. Broadband is of that same nature. The states have a hard time. Again, it's we all understand that they're maybe in that mesoeconomic range. It's not a micro, it's not a macro, but they have options, but they're limited relative to the federal government. Wisconsin cannot lay a tax on Wall Street. The federal government can. So I'm definitely not a starve the beast, shrink the government kind of person. The world has changed. It's getting more and more complex. We're asking the government to do more and more. The federal government has resources. They should, or they could easily, well, okay, not easily, but they could, if it was a priority, raise more money, and we can then increase the federal aid to all the states.
Thanks for the call. You mentioned of your four top priorities, money and politics and health care. What were the other two on your top list?
Okay, money the top list, but then health care, mm-hmm. education, again, the transition from a K-12 to K-14, and Hillary has adopted Bernie's, on the platform, the most liberal democratic platform ever. We'll have to see how much gets transferred. And then energy/environment. A lot of people say that we invaded Iraq twice because of oil. The free market does not price externalities, pollution. You know, the Republican convention is in Cleveland. The Cuyahoga River runs through it. In the 60s and 70s, that river was always catching fire because all the industries upstream were dumping their effluent right into the river. It was free. So again, the environment, energy, we need to transition fast to a green energy. That's the one case where trickle-down economics works. The federal government should invest in green energies, and that will work well.
Very briefly, a last message to voters for Election Day.
Again, this could really be a transition election, especially in Wisconsin, going from 2010 and the Republican overreach. They control all three branches of government. We can not run down the list, education, open records, environment. Again, we just saw in the paper again today about voter ID and that's silly, all the aspects of the voter suppression. It's again, it could easily be a change election. And one other point is that 4 years ago, Zerbon lost to Paul Ryan. Paul Ryan had 54.9%. That was after the 2% gerrymander. This county, this CD, and all the people up and down can swing.
Tom, thanks a lot for joining us. That was Tom Brey, candidate for Congress in the 1st District Democratic primary. His Democratic opponent, Ryan Solon, joined us yesterday. You can hear that interview at WPR.org and check out WisconsinVote.org for more. If you've ever listened to a dentist, or anyone, really, you know two things about taking care of your teeth. Brush and floss. Brush and floss.
But the Associated Press made a public information request to two federal departments that endorse flossing, the Departments of Agriculture and Health and Human Services. And in the research information that they got back, the evidence for the benefits of flossing is called weak and very unreliable.
Now, don't toss the floss just yet. The American Dental Association has a statement out today saying flossing is still good for us. Keep doing it. Everybody seems to agree we could use some better long-term research to see if and what the benefits of flossing are. My response, I'm going to keep flossing, I think. I got myself into the habit of staying with it.
It seems safe to keep flossing. I mean, we know one thing. Flossing is good for getting food out of your teeth.
Right.
So there's a benefit right there.
At a very basic level.
On the other hand, to play devil's advocate, sometimes there is a guilt burden
that comes along.
Floss shaming, exactly. So it might be nice to throw off the mantle of floss shaming. Maybe I'll do the opposite and I'll stop and then we'll compare teeth in a year.
It's perfect research. The latest on dental hygiene here on Central Time.
So I know the drill. I smooth my hair, sit back in the chair, but somehow I still get the chill.